The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I will continue our series on the short stories published by J.D. Salinger in the New Yorker. Today, I'll complete the last two of the four short stories he wrote in 1948. Uncle Wiggily in Connecticut, and Just Before the War with the Eskimos. And now, from the March 20th, 1948 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Uncle Wiggily in Connecticut by J.D. Salinger. It was almost 3 o'clock when Mary Jane finally found Eloise's house. She explained to Eloise, who had come out to the driveway to meet her, that everything had been absolutely perfect, that she had remembered the way exactly until she had turned off the Merritt Parkway. Eloise said, "Merritt Parkway, baby," and reminded Mary Jane that she had found the house twice before. But Mary Jane just wailed something ambiguous, something about her box of Kleenex, and rushed back to her convertible. Eloise turned up the collar of her camel's hair coat, put her back to the wind, and waited. Mary Jane was back in a minute, using a leaf of Kleenex and still looking upset, even fouled. Eloise said cheerfully that the whole damn lunch was burned, sweetbreads, everything. But Mary Jane said she'd eaten anyway, on the road. As the two walked toward the house, Eloise asked Mary Jane how it happened she had the day off. Mary Jane said she didn't have the whole day off. It was just that Mr. Weinberg had a hernia and was home in Larchmont, and she had to bring his mail and take a couple of letters every afternoon. She asked Eloise, "Just exactly what is a hernia, anyway?" Eloise, dropping her cigarette on the soiled snow underfoot, said she didn't actually know, but that Mary Jane didn't have to worry much about getting one. Mary Jane said, "Oh," and the two girls entered the house. 20 minutes later, they were finishing their first highball in the living room and were talking in the manner peculiar, probably limited, to former college roommates. They had an even stronger bond between them. Neither of them had graduated. Eloise had left college in the middle of her sophomore year in 1942, a week after she had been caught with a soldier in a closed elevator on the third floor of her residence hall. Mary Jane had left, same year, same class, almost the same month, to marry an aviation cadet stationed in Jacksonville, Florida, a lean, air-minded boy from Dill, Mississippi, who had spent 2 of the 3 months Mary Jane had been married to him in jail for stabbing an MP. "No," Eloise was saying, "it was actually red." She was stretched out on the couch, her thin but very pretty legs crossed at the ankles. "I heard it was blonde," Mary Jane repeated. She was seated in the blue straight chair. "What do you call it? Swore up and down it was blonde." "Uh-uh, definitely," Eloise yawned. "I was almost in the room with her when she dyed it. What's the matter? Aren't there any cigarettes in there?" "It's all right. I have a whole pack," Mary Jane said. "Somewhere." She searched through her handbag. "That dopey maid," Eloise said without moving from the couch. "I dropped 2 brand new cartons in front of her nose about an hour ago. She'll be in any minute to ask me what to do with them." "Where the hell was I?" "Theringer," Mary Jane prompted, lighting one of her own cigarettes. "Oh, yeah, I remember exactly. She dyed it the night before she married that Frank Hinkey. You remember him at all?" Just sort of. Little old private, terribly unattractive." "Unattractive? God, he looked like an unwashed Bela Lugosi." Mary Jane threw back her head and roared. "Marvelous," she said, coming back into drinking position. "Give me your glass," Eloise said, swinging her stockinged feet to the floor and standing up. "Honestly, that dope. I did everything but get Lou to make love to her to get her to come out here with us. Now I'm sorry I... Where'd you get that thing?" "This," said Mary Jane, touching a cameo brooch at her throat. I had it at school, for goodness sakes. It was Mother's. God, Eloise said with the empty glasses in her hands, I don't have one damn thing holy to wear. If Lou's mother ever dies, ha ha, she'll probably leave me some old monogrammed ice pick or something. How are you getting along with her these days, anyway? Don't be funny, Eloise said on her way to the kitchen. This is positively the last one for me, Mary Jane called after her. Like hell it is, who called who? And who came 2 hours late? You're going to stick around till I'm sick of you. The hell with your lousy career. Mary Jane threw back her head and roared again, but Eloise had already gone into the kitchen. With little or no wherewithal for being left alone in a room, Mary Jane stood up and walked over to the window. She drew aside the curtain and leaned her wrist on one of the cross pieces between panes. But, feeling grit, she removed it, rubbed it clean with her other hand, and stood up more erectly. Outside, the filthy slush was visibly turning to ice. Mary Jane let go the curtain and wandered back to the blue chair, passing two heavily stocked bookcases without glancing at any of the titles. Seated, she opened her handbag and used the mirror to look at her teeth. She closed her lips and ran her tongue hard over her upper front teeth, and then took another look. It's getting so icy out, she said. God, that was quick. Didn't you put any soda in them? Eloise, with a fresh drink in each hand, stopped short. She extended both index fingers, gun muzzle style, and said, Don't nobody move. I got the whole damn place surrounded. Mary Jane laughed and put away her mirror. Eloise came forward with the drinks. She placed Mary Jane's insecurely in its coaster, but kept her own in hand. She stretched out on the couch again. What do you think she's doing out there? She said. She's sitting on her big black butt reading The Robe. I dropped the ice trays taking them out. She actually looked up annoyed. This is my last, and I mean it, Mary Jane said, picking up her drink. Oh, listen, you know who I saw last week on the main floor of Lord and Taylor's? Said Eloise, adjusting a pillow under her head. Akeem Tamaroff. Who? Said Mary Jane. Who's he? Akeem Tamaroff? He's in the movies. He always says, You make big joke, huh? I love him. There isn't one damn pillow in this house that I can stand. Who'd you see? Jackson. She was. Which one? I don't know. The one that was in our psych class. That always both of them were in our psych class. Well, the one with the terrific Marcia Louise. I ran into her once, too, but she talked your ear off. God, yes, but you know what she told me, though? Dr. Whiting's dead. She said she had a letter from Barbara Hill saying Whiting got cancer last summer and died and all. She only weighed 62 pounds when she died. Isn't that terrible? No. Eloise, you're getting hard as nails. What else she say? Oh, she just got back from Europe. Her husband was stationed in Germany or something, and she was with him. They had a 47-room house, she said, just with one other couple and about 10 servants. Her own horse and the groom they had used to be Hitler's own private riding master or something. Oh, and she started to tell me how she almost got raped by a colored soldier. Right on the main floor of Lord and Taylor's, she started to tell me, you know, Jackson, she said he was with her husband's chauffeur and he was driving her to market or something one morning. She said she was so scared she didn't even... Wait a second. Eloise raised her head and her voice. Is that you, Ramona? Yes, a small child's voice answered. Close the front door after you, please, Eloise called. Is that Ramona? Oh, I'm dying to see her. Do you realize I haven't seen her since she had her... Ramona! Eloise shouted with her eyes shut. Go out in the kitchen and let Grace take your galoshes off. All right, said Ramona. Come on, Jimmy. Oh, I'm dying to see her, Mary Jane said. Oh, God, look what I did. I'm terribly sorry, Elle. Leave it, said Eloise. I hate this damn rug anyway. I'll get you another. No, look, I have more than half left. Mary Jane held up her glass. Sure, said Eloise. Give me a cigarette. Mary Jane extended her pack of cigarettes, saying, Oh, I'm dying to see her. Who does she look like now? Eloise struck a light. Akim Tamarov. No, seriously. Lou. She looks like Lou. When his mother comes over, the three of them look like triplets. Without sitting up, Eloise reached for a stack of ashtrays on the far side of the cigarette table. She successfully lifted off the top one and set it down on her stomach. What I need is a cocker spaniel or something, she said. Somebody that looks like me. How are her eyes now? Mary Jane asked. I mean, they're not any worse or anything, are they? God, not that I know of. Can she see at all without her glasses? I mean, if she gets up in the night to go to the John or something? She won't tell anybody. She's lousy with secrets. Mary Jane turned around in her chair. Well, hello, Ramona, she said. Oh, what a pretty dress. She set down her drink. I'll bet you don't even remember me, Ramona. Certainly she does. Who's the lady, Ramona? Mary Jane, said Ramona, and scratched herself. Marvelous, said Mary Jane. Ramona, will you give me a little kiss? Stop that, Eloise said to Ramona. Ramona stopped scratching herself. Will you give me a little kiss, Ramona? Mary Jane asked again. I don't like to kiss people. Eloise snorted and asked, Where's Jimmy? He's here. Who's Jimmy? Mary Jane asked Eloise. Oh, God, her beau. Goes where she goes, does what she does. All very hoopla. Really? Said Mary Jane enthusiastically. She leaned forward. Do you have a beau, Ramona? Ramona's eyes, behind thick counter myopia lenses, did not reflect even the smallest part of Mary Jane's enthusiasm. Mary Jane asked you a question, Ramona, Eloise said. Ramona inserted a finger into her small, broad nose. Stop that, Eloise said. Mary Jane asked you if you have a beau. Yes, said Ramona, busy with her nose. Ramona, Eloise said, cut that out, but immediately. Ramona put her hand out. Well, I think that's just wonderful, Mary Jane said. What's his name? Will you tell me his name, Ramona, or is it a big secret? Jimmy, Ramona said. Jimmy, oh, I love the name Jimmy. Jimmy what, Ramona? Jimmy Timorino, said Ramona. Stand still, said Eloise. Well, that's quite a name. Where is Jimmy? Will you tell me, Ramona? Here, said Mary Jane looked around and then looked back at Ramona, smiling as provocatively as possible. Here where, honey? Here, said Ramona. I'm holding his hand. I don't get it, Mary Jane said to Eloise, who was finishing her drink. Don't look at me, said Eloise. Mary Jane looked back at Ramona. Oh, I see. Jimmy's just a make-believe little boy. Marvelous. Mary Jane leaned forward cordially. How do you do, Jimmy? She said. He won't talk to you, said Eloise. Ramona, tell Mary Jane about Jimmy. Tell her what? Stand up, please. Tell Mary Jane how Jimmy looks. He has green eyes and black hair. What else? No mommy and no daddy. What else? No freckles. What else? A sword. What else? I don't know, said Ramona and began to scratch herself again. He sounds beautiful, Mary Jane said and leaned even farther forward in her chair. Ramona, tell me. Did Jimmy take off his galoshes, too, when you came in? He has boots, Ramona said. Marvelous, Mary Jane said to Eloise. You just think so. I get it all day long. Jimmy eats with her, takes a bath with her, sleeps with her. She sleeps way over to one side of the bed so as not to roll over and hurt him. Looking absorbed and delighted with this information, Mary Jane took in her lower lip, then released it to ask, Where'd he get that name, though? Jimmy Timorino? God knows. Probably from some little boy in the neighborhood. Eloise, yawning, shook her head. There are no little boys in the neighborhood. no children at all. They call me Fertile Fanny behind my... Mommy, Ramona said, can I go out and play? Eloise looked at her. You just came in, she said. Jimmy wants to go out again. Why, may I ask? He left his sword outside. Oh, him and his goddamn sword, Eloise said. Well, go ahead, put your galoshes back on. Can I have this? Ramona said, taking a burned match out of the ashtray. May I have this? Yes. Stay out of the street, please. Goodbye, Ramona, said Mary Jane musically. Bye, said Ramona. Come on, Jimmy. Eloise lunged suddenly to her feet. Give me your glass, she said. No, really, El, I'm supposed to be in Larchmont. I mean, Mr. Weinberg's so sweet, I hate to... Call up and say you were killed. Let go of that damn glass. No, honestly, El, I mean, it's getting so terribly icy. I have hardly any antifreeze in the car. I mean, if I don't... Let it freeze. Go phone, say you're dead, said Eloise. Give me that. Well, where's the phone? It went, said Eloise, carrying the empty glasses and walking toward the dining room. This-a-way. She stopped short on the floorboard between the living room and the dining room and executed a grind and a bump. Mary Jane giggled. I mean, you really didn't know, Walt, said Eloise at 4:45, lying on her back on the floor, a drink balanced upright on her small-breasted chest. He was the only boy I ever knew that could make me laugh. I mean, really laugh. She looked over at Mary Jane. You remember that night, our first year, when that crazy Louise Hermanson busted in the room wearing that black brassiere she bought in Chicago? Mary Jane giggled. She was lying on her stomach on the couch, her chin on the armrest facing Eloise. Her drink was on the floor, within reach. Well, he could make me laugh that way, Eloise said. He could do it when he talked to me. He could do it over the phone. He could even do it in a letter. And the best thing about it was that he didn't even try to be funny. He just was funny. She turned her head slightly toward Mary Jane. Hey, how about throwing me a cigarette? I can't reach him, Mary Jane said. Nuts to you, Eloise looked up at the ceiling again. Once, she said, I fell down. I used to wait for him at the bus stop, right outside the PX, and he showed up late once, just as the bus was pulling out. We started to run for it, and I fell and twisted my ankle. And he said, Poor Uncle Wiggily. He meant my ankle. Poor old Uncle Wiggily, he called it. God, he was nice. Doesn't Lou have a sense of humor? Mary Jane said. What? Doesn't Lou have a sense of humor? Oh, God, who knows? Yes, I guess so. He laughs at cartoons and stuff. Eloise raised her head, lifted her drink from her chest, and drank from it. Well, Mary Jane said, that isn't everything. I mean, that isn't everything. What isn't? Oh, you know, laughing and stuff. Who says it isn't? Eloise said. Listen, if you're not going to be a nun or something, you might as well laugh. Mary Jane giggled. You're terrible, she said. Ah, God, he was nice, Eloise said. He was either funny... Not that damn little boy sweet, either. It was a special kind of sweet. You know what he did once? Uh-uh, Mary Jane said. We were on the train going from Trenton to New York. It was just right after he was drafted. It was cold in the car, and I had my coat sort of over us. And I remember I had Joyce Morrow's cardigan on underneath. You remember that darling blue cardigan she had? Mary Jane nodded, but Eloise didn't look over to get the nod. Well, he sort of had his hand on my stomach, you know, and anyway, all of a sudden, he said my stomach was so beautiful, he wished some officer would come up and order him to stick his other hand through the window. He wanted to do what was fair. Then he took his hand away and told the conductor to throw his shoulders back. He told him that if there was one thing he couldn't stand, it was a man who didn't look proud of his uniform. That conductor just told him to go back to sleep. Eloise reflected a moment and then said, "It wasn't always what he said, but how he said it, you know? Have you ever told Lou about him? I mean, at all?" "Oh," Eloise said, "I started to once, but the first thing he asked me was what was his rank." "What was his rank?" "Ha!" said Eloise. "No, I just meant..." Eloise laughed suddenly from her diaphragm. "You know what he said once? He said he felt he was advancing in the army, but in a different direction from everybody else. He said that when he'd get his first promotion, instead of getting stripes, he'd have his sleeves taken away from him. He said when he'd get to be a general, he'd be stark naked, and all he'd be wearing would be a little infantry button in his navel." Eloise looked over at Mary Jane, who wasn't laughing. "Don't you think that's funny?" "Yes, only why don't you tell Lou about him sometime, though?" "Why? Because he's too damn unintelligent, that's why," Eloise said. "Besides, listen to me, career girl. If you ever get married again, don't tell your husband anything. Do you hear me?" "Why?" said Mary Jane. "Because I say so, that's why," said Eloise. "They want to think you spent your whole life vomiting every time a boy came near you." "I'm not kidding either. Oh, you can tell them stuff, but never honestly. I mean, never honestly. If you tell them you once knew a handsome boy, you got to say in the same breath that he was too handsome. And if you tell him you knew a witty boy, you got to tell him he was kind of a smart aleck, though, or a wise guy. If you don't, they hit you over the head with the poor boy every time they get a chance." Eloise paused to drink from her glass and to think. "Oh," she said, "they'll listen very maturely and all that. They'll even look intelligent as hell, but don't let it fool you. Believe me, you'll go through hell if you ever give them any credit for intelligence. Take my word." Mary Jane, looking depressed, raised her chin from the armrest. For a change, she supported her chin on her forearm. She thought over Eloise's advice. "You can't call Lou not intelligent," she said aloud. "Who can't?" "I mean, isn't he intelligent?" Mary Jane said innocently. "Oh," said Eloise, "what's the use of talking? Let's drop it. I'll just depress you. Shut me." "Well, what'd you marry him for, then?" Mary Jane said. "Oh, God, I don't know. He told me he loved Jane Austen. He told me her books meant a great deal to him. That's exactly what he said. I found out after we were married that he hadn't even read one of her books. You know who his favorite author is?" Mary Jane shook her head. "L. Manning Vines. Ever hear of him?" "Uh-uh. Neither did I. Neither did anybody else. He wrote a book about four men that starved to death in Alaska. Lou doesn't remember the name of it, but it's the most beautifully written book he's ever read. Christ! He isn't even honest enough to come right out and say he liked it because it was about four guys that starved to death in an igloo or something. He has to say it was beautifully written." "You're too critical," Mary Jane said. "I mean, you're far too critical. Maybe it was a good..." "Take my word for it, it couldn't have been," Eloise said. She thought for a moment and then added, "At least you have a job. I mean, at least..." "But listen, though," said Mary Jane. "Do you think you'll ever tell him Walt was killed, even? I mean, he wouldn't be jealous, would he, if he knew Walt was, you know, killed and everything?" "Oh, lover, you poor, innocent little career girl," said Eloise. "He'd be worse. He'd be a ghoul. Listen, all he knows is that I went around with somebody named Walt, some wisecracking GI. The last thing I'd do would be to tell him he was killed. But the last thing. And if I did, which I wouldn't, but if I did, I'd tell him he was killed in action." Mary Jane pushed her chin farther forward over the edge of her forearm. "Well," she said, "huh? Why won't you tell me how he was killed? I swear I won't tell anybody, honestly. Please." "No. Please, honestly, I won't tell anybody." Eloise finished her drink and replaced the empty glass upright on her chest. "You tell Akim Tamarov," she said. "No, I wouldn't. I mean, I wouldn't tell in..." "Oh," said Eloise, "his regiment was resting someplace. It was between battles or something, this friend of his said that wrote me. Walt and some other boy were putting this little Japanese stove in a package. Some colonel wanted to send it home, or they were taking it out of the package to rewrap it. I don't know exactly. Anyway, it was all full of gasoline and junk, and it exploded in their face. The other boy just lost an eye." Eloise began to cry. She put her hand around the empty glass on her chest to steady. Mary Jane slid off the couch and, on her knees, took 3 steps over to Eloise and began to stroke her forehead. "Don't cry, El. Don't cry." "Who's crying?" Eloise said. "I know, but don't. I mean, it isn't worth it or anything." The front door opened. "That's Ramona's back," Eloise said nasally. "Do me a favor. Get out in the kitchen and tell Hoosis to give her dinner early, will you?" "All right, if you promise not to cry, though." "I promise. Go on. I don't feel like going out to that damn kitchen right this minute." Mary Jane stood up, losing and recovering her balance, and left the room. She was back in less than 2 minutes, with Ramona running ahead of her. Ramona ran as flat-footed as possible, trying to get the maximum noise out of her open galoshes. "She wouldn't let me take her galoshes off," Mary Jane said. Eloise, still lying on her back on the floor, was using her handkerchief. She spoke into it, addressing Ramona. "Go out and tell Grace to take your galoshes off. You know you're not supposed to come into the..." "She's in the lavatory," Ramona said. Eloise put away her handkerchief and hoisted herself to a sitting position. "Give me your foot," she said. "Sit down first, please. Not there, here, God!" On her knees, looking under the table for her cigarettes, Mary Jane said, "Hey, guess what happened to Jimmy?" "No idea. Weatherfoot." "Other foot. He got runned over," said Mary Jane. "Isn't that tragic?" "I saw a skipper with a bone," Ramona told Eloise. "Well, what happened to Jimmy?" Eloise said to her. "He got rummed over and killed. I saw a skipper with a bone, and he wouldn't..." "Give me your forehead a second," Eloise said. She reached out and felt Ramona's forehead. "You feel a little feverish. Go tell Grace you're to have your dinner upstairs. Then you're to go straight to bed. I'll be up later. Go on now, please. Take these with you." Ramona slowly giant-stepped her way out of the room. "Draw me one," Eloise said to Mary Jane. "Let's have another drink." Mary Jane carried a cigarette over to Eloise. "Isn't that something about Jimmy? What an imagination." "You go get the drinks, huh? And bring the bottle. I don't want to go out there. The whole damn place smells like orange juice." At 7:05, the phone rang. Eloise got up from the window seat and felt in the dark for her shoes. She couldn't find them. In her stocking feet, she walked steadily, almost languidly, toward the phone. The ringing didn't disturb Mary Jane, who was asleep on the couch, face down. "Hello?" Eloise said into the phone, without having turned the overhead light on. "Look, I can't meet you. Mary Jane's here. She's got her car parked right in front of me, and she can't find the key. I can't get out. We spent about 20 minutes looking for it in the, what do you call it, the snow and stuff. Maybe you can get a lift with Dick and Mildred." She listened. "Oh, well, that's tough, kid. Why don't you boys form a platoon and march home? You can say that hut, hope, hoop, hoop business, and you can be the big shot." She listened again. "I'm not funny," she said. "Really, I'm not. It's just my face." And she hung up. She walked less steadily back into the living room. At the window seat, she poured what was left in the bottle of scotch into her glass. It made about a finger. She drank it off, shivered, and sat down. When Grace turned on the light in the dining room, Eloise jumped. Without getting up, she called into Grace. "You better not serve until 8, Grace. Mr. Wingler will be a little late." Grace appeared in the dining room light, but didn't come forward. "The lady go?" she said. "She's resting." "Oh," said Grace. "Miss Wingler, I wondered if it'd be all right if my husband passed the evening here. I got plenty of room in my room, and he doesn't have to go back in New York till tomorrow morning, and it's so bad out."
"Your husband? Where is he?"
"Well, right now," Grace said, "he's in the kitchen."
"Well, I'm afraid he can't spend the night here, Grace."
"Ma'am? I say I'm afraid he can't spend the night here. I'm not running a hotel."
Grace stood for a moment and then said, "Yes, ma'am," and went out to the kitchen. Eloise left the living room and climbed the stairs, which were lighted very faintly by the overglow from the dining room. One of Ramona's galoshes was lying on the landing. Eloise picked it up and threw it, with as much force as possible, over the side of the banister. It struck the foyer floor with a violent thump. She snapped on the light in Ramona's room and held on to the switch, as if for support. She stood still for a moment looking at Ramona. Then she let go of the light switch and went quickly over to the bed.
"Ramona, wake up! Wake up!"
Ramona was sleeping far over on one side of the bed, her right buttock off the edge. Her glasses were on a little Donald Duck night table, folded neatly and laid stems down.
"Ramona!"
The child awoke with a sharp intake of breath. Her eyes opened wide, but she narrowed them almost at once.
"Mommy? I thought you told me Jimmy Jimmerino was run over and killed."
"What?
You heard me," Eloise said. "Why are you sleeping way over here?"
"Because," said Ramona.
"Because why, Ramona? I don't feel like..."
"Because I don't want to hurt Mickey."
"Who?"
"Mickey," said Ramona, rubbing her nose.
"Mickey Micarano."
Eloise raised her voice to a shriek.
"You get in the center of that bed! Go on!"
Ramona, extremely frightened, just looked up at Eloise.
"All right."
Eloise grabbed Ramona's ankles and half-lifted and half-pulled her over to the middle of the bed. Ramona neither struggled nor cried. She let herself be moved without actually submitting to it.
"Now go to sleep," Eloise said, breathing heavily. "Close your eyes. You heard me. Close them."
Ramona closed her eyes. Eloise went over to the light switch and flicked it off. But she stood for a long time in the doorway. Then suddenly she rushed in the dark over to the night table, banging her knee against the foot of the bed, but too full of purpose to feel pain. She picked up Ramona's glasses and, holding them in both hands, pressed them against her cheek. Tears rolled down her face, wetting the lenses.
"Poor Uncle Wiggily," she said over and over again.
Finally, she put the glasses back on the night table, lenses down. She stooped over, losing her balance, and began to tuck in the blankets of Ramona's bed. Ramona was awake. She was crying and had been crying. Eloise kissed her wetly on the mouth and wiped the hair out of her eyes and then left the room. She went downstairs, staggering now very badly, and awakened Mary Jane.
"What was it? What? Who? What? Huh?"
said Mary Jane, sitting bolt upright on the couch.
"Mary Jane, listen, please," Eloise said, sobbing. "You remember our freshman year, and I had that brown and yellow dress I bought in Boise, and Marion Ball told me nobody wore those kinds of dresses in New York, and I cried all night."
Eloise shook Mary Jane's arm.
"I was a nice girl," she pleaded. "Wasn't I?"
Next, from the June 5th, 1948 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Just Before the War with the Eskimos, by J.D. Salinger.
5 straight Saturday mornings, Jenny Mannix had played tennis at the East Side Courts with Selena Graff, a classmate at Miss Basehour's. Jenny openly considered Selena the biggest drip at Miss Basehour's, a school ostensibly abounding with fair-sized drips. But at the same time, she had never known anyone like Selena for bringing fresh cans of tennis balls. Selena's father made them or something. At dinner one night, for the edification of the entire Mannix family, Jenny had conjured up a vision of dinner over at the Graffs. It involved a perfect servant coming around to everyone's left with, instead of a glass of tomato juice, a can of tennis balls. But this business of dropping Selena off at her house after tennis and then getting stuck every single time for the whole cab fare was getting on Jenny's nerves. After all, taking the taxi home from the courts instead of the bus had been Selena's idea. On the fifth Saturday, however, as the cab started north on York Avenue, Jenny suddenly spoke up. "Hey, Selena." "What?" asked Selena, who was busy feeling the floor of the cab with her hand. "I can't find the cover to my racket," she moaned. Despite the warm May weather, both girls were wearing top coats over their shorts. "You put it in your pocket," Jenny said. "Hey, listen." "Oh, God, you've saved my life." "Listen," said Jenny, who wanted no part of Selena's gratitude. "What?" Jenny decided to come right out with it. The cab was nearly at Selena's street. "I don't feel like getting stuck for the whole cab fare again today," she said. "I'm no millionaire, you know." Selena looked first amazed and then hurt. "Don't I always pay half?" she asked innocently. "No," said Jenny flatly. "You paid half the first Saturday, way in the beginning of last month. And since then, not even once. Now, I don't want to be ratty, but I'm actually existing on $4.50 a week. And out of that, I always bring the tennis balls, don't I?" Selena asked unpleasantly. Sometimes Jenny felt like killing Selena. "Your father makes them or something," she said. "They don't cost you anything. I have to pay for every single little..." all right," Selena said, loudly and with finality enough to give herself the upper hand. Looking bored, she went through the pockets of her coat. "I only have 35 cents," she said coldly. "Is that enough?" "No, I'm sorry, but you owe me $1.65. I've been keeping track of every..." "I'll have to go upstairs and get it from my mother." "Can't it wait till Monday? I could bring it to the gym with me if that'd make you happy." Selena's attitude defied clemency. "No," Jenny said. "I have to go to the movies tonight. I need it." In hostile silence, the girls stared out of opposite windows until the cab pulled up in front of Selena's apartment house. Then Selena, who was seated nearest the curb, let herself out. Just barely leaving the cab door open, she walked briskly and obliviously, like visiting Hollywood royalty, into the building. Jenny, her face burning, paid the fare. She then collected her tennis things, racket, hand towel, and sun hat, and followed Selena. At 15, Jenny was about 5'9" in her 9B tennis shoes, and as she entered the lobby, her self-conscious, rubber-soled awkwardness lent her a dangerous amateur quality. It made Selena prefer to watch the indicator dial over the elevator. "That makes $1.90 you owe me," Jenny said, striding up to the elevator. Selena turned. "It may just interest you to know," she said, "that my mother is very ill." "What's the matter with her?" "She virtually has pneumonia, and if you think I'm going to enjoy disturbing her just for money..." Selena delivered the incomplete sentence with all possible aplomb. Jenny was, in fact, slightly put off by this information, whatever its degree of truth, but not to the point of sentimentality. "I didn't give it to her," she said, and followed Selena into the elevator. When Selena had rung her apartment bell, the girls were admitted, or rather the door was drawn in and left ajar, by a maid with whom Selena didn't seem to be on speaking terms. Jenny dropped her tennis things on a chair in the foyer and followed Selena. In the living room, Selena turned and said, "Do you mind waiting here? I may have to wake Mother up and everything." "Okay," Jenny said and plopped down on the sofa. "I never in my life would have thought you could be so small about anything," said Selena, who was just angry enough to use the word small, but not quite brave enough to emphasize it. "Well, now you know," said Jenny and opened a copy of Vogue in front of her face. She kept it in this position till Selena had left the room, then put it back on top of the radio. She looked around the room, mentally rearranging furniture, throwing out table lamps, removing artificial flowers. In her opinion, it was an altogether hideous room, expensive but cheesy. Suddenly, a male voice shouted from another part of the apartment. "Eric, that you?" Jenny guessed it was Selena's brother, whom she had never seen. She crossed her long legs, arranged the hem of her polo coat over her knees, and waited. A young man, wearing glasses and pajamas and no slippers, lunged into the room with his mouth open.
"Oh, I thought it was Eric, for Christ's sake," he said.
Without stopping, and with extremely poor posture, he continued across the room, cradling something close to his narrow chest. He sat down on the vacant end of the sofa.
"I just cut my goddamn finger," he said rather wildly.
He looked at Jenny as if he had expected her to be sitting here.
"Ever cut your finger? Right down to the bone and all?" he asked.
There was a real appeal in his noisy voice, as if Jenny, by her answer, could save him from some particularly isolating form of pioneering. Jenny stared at him.
"Well, not right down to the bone," she said, "but I've cut myself."
He was the funniest-looking boy, or man, it was hard to tell which he was, she had ever seen. His hair was bed-disheveled. He had a couple of days' growth of sparse, blonde beard, and he looked, well, goofy.
"How'd you cut it?" she asked.
He was staring down with his slack mouth ajar at his injured finger.
"What?"
he said. "How did you cut it?"
"God damn if I know," he said, his inflection implying that the answer
to that question was hopelessly obscure. "I was looking for something in the goddamn wastebasket, and it was full of razor blades."
"You Selena's brother?" Jenny asked.
"Yeah, Christ, I'm bleeding to death. Stick around. I may need a goddamn transfusion."
"Did you put anything on it?"
Selena's brother carried his wound slightly forward from his chest and unveiled it for Jenny's benefit.
"Just some goddamn toilet paper," he said. "Stops the bleeding, like when you cut yourself shaving."
He looked at Jenny again.
"Who are you?" he asked. "Friend of the jerks?"
"We're in the same class."
"Yeah? What's your name?"
"Virginia Mannix."
"You Jenny?" he said, squinting at her through his glasses. "You Jenny Mannix?"
"Yes," said Jenny, uncrossing her legs. Selena's brother turned back to his finger, obviously for him the true and only focal point in the room. "I know your sister," he said dispassionately. "Goddamn snob." Jenny arched her back.
"Who is?"
"You heard me.
She is not a snob."
"The hell she's not," said Selena's brother.
"She is not."
"The hell she's not. She's the queen. Queen of the goddamn snobs." Jenny watched him lift up and peer under the thick folds of toilet paper on his finger.
"You don't even know my sister." "Hell, I don't."
"Well, what's her name? What's her first name?" Jenny demanded. "Joan. Joan the snob." Jenny was silent.
"What's she look like?"
she asked suddenly. No answer.
"What's she look like?" Jenny repeated. "If she was half as good looking as she thinks she is, she'd be goddamn lucky," Selena's brother said.
This had the stature of an interesting answer, in Jenny's secret opinion.
"I never heard her mention you," she said.
"Well, that worries me. That worries the hell out of me." "Anyway, she's engaged," Jenny said, watching him. "She's going to be married next month."
"Who to?" he asked, looking up.
Jenny took full advantage of his having looked up.
"Nobody you know."
He resumed picking at his own first aid work. "I pity him," he said. Jenny snorted.
"It's still bleeding like mad. You think I ought to put something on it?"
"What's good to put on it?
Mercurochrome any good?"
"Iodine's better," Jenny said. Then, feeling her answer was too civil under the circumstances, she added,
"Mercurochrome's no good at all for that."
"Why not? What's the matter with it?"
"It just isn't any good for that stuff, that's all. You need iodine."
He looked at Jenny. "It stings a lot, though, doesn't it?"
he asked. "Doesn't it sting a hell of a lot?"
"It stings," Jenny said, "but it won't kill you or anything." Apparently, without resenting Jenny's tone, Selena's brother turned back to his finger.
I don't like it when it stings, he said.
Nobody does. He nodded in agreement.
Yeah, he said.
Jenny watched him for a minute. Stop touching it, she said suddenly. As though responding to an electric shock, Selena's brother pulled back his uninjured hand. He sat up a trifle straighter, or rather slumped a trifle less. He looked at some object on the other side of the room. An almost dreamy expression came over his disorderly features. He inserted the nail of his uninjured index finger into the crevice between two front teeth and, removing a food particle, turned to Jenny.
Cheat yet?
He asked.
What? Cheat lunch yet?
Jenny shook her head. I'll eat when I get home, she said. My mother always has lunch ready for me when I get home.
I got half a chicken sandwich in my room. You want it? I didn't touch it or anything.
No, thank you, really.
You just played tennis, for Christ's sake. Aren't you hungry?
It isn't that, said Jenny, crossing her legs. It's just that my mother always has lunch ready when I get home. She goes insane if I'm not hungry, I mean.
Selena's brother seemed to accept this explanation. At least, he nodded and looked away.
But he turned back suddenly. How about a glass of milk? He said.
No, thanks, thank you.
Absently, he bent over and scratched his bare ankle.
What's the name of this guy she's marrying? He asked.
Joan, you mean? Said Jenny.
Dick Hefner.
Selena's brother went on scratching his ankle.
He's a lieutenant commander in the Navy, Jenny said.
Big deal. Jenny giggled. She watched him scratch his ankle till it was red. When he began to scratch off a minor skin eruption on his calf with his fingernail, she stopped watching.
Where do you know Joan from? She asked.
I never saw you at the house or anything.
Never been at your goddamn house.
Jenny waited, but nothing led away from this statement.
Where'd you meet her then?
She asked.
Party, he said.
At a party? When?
I don't know. Christmas 42?
From his breast pajama pocket, he two-fingered out a cigarette that looked as though it had been slept on.
How about throwing me those matches, he said.
Jenny handed him a box of matches from the table beside her. He lit his cigarette without straightening out its curvature, and then replaced the used match in the box. Tilting his head back, he slowly released an enormous quantity of smoke from his mouth and drew it up through his nostrils. He continued to smoke in this French inhale style. Very probably it was not part of the sofa vaudeville of a show-off, but rather the private exposed achievement of a young man who, at one time or another, might have tried shaving himself left-handed.
Why's Joan a snob? Jenny asked.
Why? Because she is. How the hell do I know why?
Yes, but, I mean, why do you say she is?
He turned to her wearily. Listen, I wrote her 8 goddamn letters. 8! And she didn't answer one of them.
Jenny hesitated. Well, maybe she was busy.
Yeah, busy. Busy as a little goddamn beaver.
Do you have to swear so much? Jenny asked.
Goddamn right I do.
Jenny giggled. How long did you know her anyway? She asked.
Long enough.
Well, I mean, did you ever phone her up or anything? I mean, didn't you ever phone her up or anything?
Nah.
Well, my gosh, if you never phoned her up or...
I couldn't, for Christ's sake.
Why not? Said Jenny.
Wasn't in New York.
Oh, where were you?
Me? Ohio.
Oh, were you in college?
Nope. Quit.
Oh, were you in the Army?
Nope.
With his cigarette hand, Selena's brother tapped the left side of his chest.
Ticker, he said.
Your heart, you mean? Jenny said. What's the matter with it?
I don't know what the hell's the matter with it. I had rheumatic fever when I was a kid. Goddamn pain in the...
Well, aren't you supposed to stop smoking? I mean, aren't you supposed to not smoke at all?
The doctor told my... Ah, they tell you a lot of stuff, he said.
Jenny briefly held her fire.
Very briefly.
What were you doing in Ohio? She asked.
Me? Working in a goddamn airplane factory.
You were? Said Jenny. Did you like it?
Did you like it? He mimicked.
I loved it. I just adore airplanes. They're so cute.
Jenny was much too involved now to feel affronted. How long did you work there, in the airplane factory?
I don't know, for Christ's sake, 37 months.
He stood up and walked over to the window. He looked down at the street, scratching his spine with his thumb.
Look at them, he said. Goddamn fools.
Who, said Jenny?
I don't know, anybody.
Your finger will start bleeding more if you hold it down that way, Jenny said. He heard her. He put his left foot up on the window seat and rested his injured hand on the horizontal thigh. He continued to look down at the street.
They're all going over to the goddamn draft board, he said. We're going to go fight Eskimos next. Know that?
The who? Said Jenny.
The Eskimos. Open your ears, for Christ's sake.
Why the Eskimos?
I don't know why. How the hell should I know why? This time all the old guys are going to go. Guys around 60. Nobody can go unless they're around 60, he said. Just give them a shorter hours is all. Big deal.
You wouldn't have to go anyway, Jenny said, without meaning anything but the truth, yet knowing before the statement was completely out that she was saying the wrong thing.
I know,
he said quickly and took his foot down from the window seat. He raised the window slightly and snapped his cigarette streetward. Then he turned, finished at the window. Hey, do me a favor. When this guy comes, will you tell him I'll be ready in a couple of seconds? I just got to go shave is all, okay? And Jenny nodded.
You want me to hurry Selena up or anything? She knows you here?
Oh, she knows I'm here, Jenny said. I'm in no hurry, thank you. Selena's brother nodded. Then he took a last long look at his injured finger, as if to see whether it was in condition to make the trip back to his room.
Why don't you put a Band-Aid on it? Don't you have any Band-Aid or anything?
Nah. Well, take it easy. And he wandered out of the room. In a few seconds, he was back, bringing the sandwich half. Eat this, he said. It's good.
Really, I'm not at all. Take it, for Christ's sake. I didn't poison it or anything.
Jenny accepted the sandwich half.
Well, thank you very much, she said.
It's chicken, he said, standing over her, watching her. Bought it last night in a goddamn delicatessen.
Well, it looks very good.
Well, eat it then. Jenny took a bite.
Good, huh?
Jenny swallowed with difficulty.
Very, she said.
Selena's brother nodded. He looked absently around the room, scratching the pit of his chest.
Well, I guess I better get dressed. Jesus, there's the bell. Take it easy now.
He was gone. Left alone, Jenny looked around without getting up for a good place to throw out or hide the sandwich. She heard someone coming through the foyer, and she put the sandwich into her polo coat pocket. A young man in his early 30s, neither short nor tall, came into the room. His regular features, his short haircut, the cut of his suit, the pattern of his necktie gave out no really final information. He might have been on the staff or trying to get on the staff of a news magazine. He might have just been in a play that closed in Philadelphia. He might have been with a law firm.
Hello, he said cordially to Jenny.
Hello. Seen Franklin, he asked.
He's shaving. He told me to tell you to wait for him. He'll be right out.
Shaving? Good heavens.
The young man looked at his wristwatch. He then sat down in a red damask chair, crossed his legs, and put his hands to it, as if he were generally weary or had just undergone some form of eye strain. He rubbed his closed eyes with the tips of his extended fingers.
This has been the most horrible morning of my entire life, he said, removing his hands from his face.
He spoke exclusively from the larynx, as if he were altogether too tired to put any diaphragm breath into his words.
What happened? Jenny asked, looking at him.
Oh, it's too long a story. I never bore people I haven't known for at least 1,000 years. And he stared vaguely, discontentedly in the direction of the windows. But I shall never again consider myself even the remotest judge of human nature. You may quote me wildly on that.
Well, what happened? Jenny repeated.
Oh, God, this person who's been sharing my apartment for months and months and months, I don't even want to talk about him. This writer, he added with satisfaction, probably remembering a favorite anathema from a Hemingway novel.
What'd he do?
Frankly, I'd just as soon not go into details, said the I really wouldn't. And he looked over at Jenny. I love your coat, he said, already out of his chair. He crossed over and took the lapel of Jenny's polo coat between his fingers. It's lovely. It's the first real good camel's hair I've seen since the war. May I ask where you got it? Oh, my mother brought it back from Nassau. The young man nodded thoughtfully and backed off toward his chair. As Selina entered the room, Jenny stood up quickly and went to meet her halfway. Selina had changed from her shorts to a dress, a fact that ordinarily would have annoyed Jenny. I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, Selina said insincerely, but I had to wait for Mother to wake up. Hello, Eric. Hello. I don't want the money anyway, Jenny said, keeping her voice down so that she was heard only by Selina. What? I've been thinking. I mean, you bring the tennis balls and all the time. I forgot about that. But you said that because I didn't have to pay for them. Walk me to the door, Jenny said, leading the way without saying goodbye to Eric. But I thought you said you were going to the movies tonight and you needed the money and all, Selina said in the foyer. I'm too tired, Jenny said. She bent over and picked up her tennis paraphernalia. Listen, I'll give you a ring after dinner. Are you doing anything special tonight? Maybe I can come over. Selina stared and said, okay. Jenny opened the front door and walked to the elevator. She rang the bell. I met your brother, she said. You did? Isn't he a character? What's he do anyway? Jenny asked casually. Does he work or something? He just quit. Daddy wants him to go back to college, but he won't go. Why won't he? I don't know. He says he's too old and all. How old is he? I don't know, 24? The elevator doors opened. I'll call you later, Jenny said. Outside the building, she started to walk west to Lexington to catch the bus. Between 3rd and Lexington, she reached into her coat pocket for her purse and found the sandwich half. She took it out and started to bring her arm down to drop the sandwich into the street, but instead she put it back into her pocket. A few years before, it had taken her 3 days to dispose of the Easter chick she had found dead on the sawdust in the bottom of her wastebasket. We've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.